Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, and Friday always means true crime time. And my special partner on Fridays is Jen. Jen, how are you?
I am fantastic. I've been playing Among Us before we started this, so I'm in a great mood. And of course, very excited. And I got to get you into this.
You told
maybe
me
the Innersense can help me, like, get you involved in this whole Among Us.
You had told me about this, and I said that I'm going to play, and I will play. It sounds like online Clue, I think, is how when you described it to me, is how I said it sounded like. And where you just, it's a murder mystery, and somebody is the murderer, and everybody else is trying to figure it out, right?
Yes, that is a very good synopsis. So I definitely want to get you into that, but super excited that it's Friday. I love to be with you. And this subject, I think, is incredibly fascinating.
It is. I mean, I think anything, I'm always interested in the whole MK Ultra thing, because no matter how many times I read about it, I think that people, there's so many things out there, and everybody goes, oh, fake news, fake news, fake news. And so when you describe MK Ultra to somebody, they're like, oh, that's got to be just a conspiracy theory. It can't be true. But it is true. 100%, 100,000%. The CIA paid, settlements to people that were injured and killed and things like that, to people of MK Ultra. And when you look at this, when you opened up the podcast, you saw a picture. It's the front page of a Washington Post where it's just headline after headline of all these things that were exposed in these hearings about MK Ultra. And just how many people were involved and how many universities and how many doctors. And it shows you, the extent to which the CIA and the Cold War, they were just looking for any kind of edge that they could get. And they didn't really care who they hurt.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that the CIA pursued the program is what it makes it so controversial. I mean, they carried out basically renditions of witcher kidnappings. They would bring people in or lure people in and then do what they wanted to them. And these people would be into this completely involuntarily. And if you ask, why didn't they bring in volunteers? Because they thought, well, subconsciously, the person would know they were a volunteer. So everything that they did to them in the back of their mind would kind of, ruin their control study. They're like, oh, that'll mess up the results. So we need people that just absolutely do not know. And that's the scary part of it. I mean, everything from, it started out with Paperclip. Then you had Project Bluebird. You've talked about Midnight Climax when you did the Laurel Canyon stuff, and you did a great job at that, by the way.
Thank you.
And then you won MK Ultra. So, that's right. What we're going to talk about today.
And I don't know if this is the person who necessarily created it so much, but I mean, right there at the heart of it. And it's this guy named Frank Olson. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Frank Olson?
Okay, yeah. So while he didn't invent it, because he's an American, the MK Ultra was basically adopted from the Nazis and the Swiss. Okay, so this is the Americans picking up where they saw the Soviets using things like this, and they decided the U.S. needed to catch up and do it also. So this guy, Frank Olson, for all intents and purposes, he was a guy who was a biochemist. He was a bacteriologist. He was also a member of the United States Army, and he dealt in biological warfare. This guy basically got the government sued for all intents and purposes because he had a very bad acid trip, and it led him to not just fall out a window, but take a swan dive out of a window. And of course he died, and the family was upset and they sued.
Yeah. So he was, you got to go back to 1943. This is a while ago. And he gets recruited to this place, Camp Dietrich, and to the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratory. And so, he is there and he's working. And at this Camp Dietrich, they have, partners like George W. Merck, who started Merck, the pharmaceutical company, and things like that. And Olson's duties included experiments with aerosolized anthrax, which just sounds horribly scary. And I've seen pictures in the laboratories where these people were working in these, and nobody's wearing like hazmat suits really or anything. They're just, they're wearing, like white outfits or something like that. But I feel like the safety protocols were not really there for these kind of things.
Well, yeah, they were definitely lax because they used to invite the military out to a field and then subject them to all of this different stuff, you know, chemicals and Agent Orange and whatnot. And the guys had no idea, you know, what the repercussions would be later. They'd end up with mesothelioma, all different types of cancers. It was awful.
And there were allegations that the U.S. used biological warfare during the Korean War, but the government denied this. I, you know, I've never really looked too detailed into it. But then the government, then they loved this Dietrich place, and so they bought more land, and you know, it's this kind of thing. And then they did studies of fluoride, and see, this is something that I didn't know. I mean, this was Project Paperclip or whatever, and then they started talking about fluoride, and it said, I did not know that fluoride was the key chemical component in atomic bomb production. I didn't know it was one of the most toxic chemicals known to man, but isn't this what we brush our teeth with every day?
Yeah, but I would imagine that the grade that they're using in some type of biological warfare is going to be different than what we brush our teeth with. It is unnerving, though.
It is. I'm just like, okay, because it said fluoride marks, you know, marked adverse effects to the central nervous system. And I'm just wondering, okay. And then, you know, there's always been this conspiracy theory, kind of like the contrails in the sky, you know, because fluoride is put into a lot of U.S. water systems. And there's always been this this big thing about they don't want it in there. And I'm thinking to myself, but then you won't get cavities, you know, just by drinking water almost. But it's kind of scary that, you know, there could be putting this, you know, lethal toxic stuff in the water system and we're just all drinking it. You know,
that is freaky. I went down a rabbit hole last week because I read something about Glitter X. It's a glitter manufacturer, and a reporter asked them kind of off the record, who is the biggest, let's say, you know, who orders the most glitter from Glitter X? And it kind of caught, like, I guess it was the CEO off guard. And he was like, you know, no thanks, no comment. He's like, no, really, who orders the most glitter? And he's like, I can't tell you. He's like, well, why can't you tell me? And he said, because the person who orders the most of it uses it for a purpose that it was not intended for. And I'd get a lot of trouble if I told you. And so I started thinking, like, who is using all the glitter? Like, what are they putting it in? You know, is it going in food? Is it going in drugs? Like, what is that about?
That is crazy. What else can you use glitter for?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, spin that in your mind for a little while. I mean, what are they doing with it? So that's like a neat rabbit hole that I want to continue to go down.
So fast forward about 4 years later in 1947 and over at Dietrich and stuff, the CIA begins its study of LSD as a potential weapon for use by American intelligence. And like you said, human subjects, both civilian and military, used with and without their knowledge. I kind of get what you were saying about they didn't want the people to know. It's horribly wrong. But if they're trying to use it as a weapon or trying to use it as interrogation techniques or something like that, then, you know, if you know that you're taking it, then you might be more susceptible to, oh, you know, this is where I'm supposed to give the answers or something like that. You know, this happened much later and even happened after Olson died, but there's this document from the CIA, an MK Ultra document. And essentially, these two women were given LSD in 1954. And they were also given this post-hypnotic kind of thing. And it said that this subject, her name was Miss Pierce, while in a state of hypnosis, being instructed to awaken another subject, Miss Jackson, and shoot her if she was unable to awaken Miss Jackson. Miss Pierce complied with the instructions. And I'm just like, oh my goodness. You know, it's just...
Well, this goes back to the whole thing of them wanting to develop not only the perfect spy, someone that if they were captured, they would not divulge a whole bunch of information that would get you know, any of the intelligence houses or the government in trouble. But also they needed to make their Manchurian candidate someone that would always be on the green light, that would not question, you know, their authority or, you know, any type of commands that were being given to them. That's what they wanted. You know, if they said shoot or they gave the signal to shoot, that person should shoot.
Yeah. I mean, and then you think about, you know, somebody like Jason Bourne or something like that. But so Frank Olson, he's helped set up this special operation division at Fort Dietrich, and no written records were allowed. None. And only a trusted few were allowed to know about the more sensitive projects. and he was tasked to develop new and secret biological means for effective interrogation and warfare, and then he became the acting head of the division. And this is where Bluebird came in, the CIA Project Bluebird, and it was supposed to invent techniques for what became known as special interrogations. And if you think about it, you know, this was 1947 or whatever, 1948, and 60 years later, I mean, we're just essentially, here's waterboarding. That's pretty much all we got. Sleep deprivation. You know, I feel like these, you know, nothing has really changed in hundreds and hundreds of years, you know?
Well, that's probably what they want everyone to think. And their arsenal is a group of chemicals that were, you know, arranged by people like not only Frank Olson, but also like Sidney Gottlieb. And those scientists put things together they could use, like LSD, all these different, you know, chemicals. And they can give it to people in cigarettes, in marijuana, in your drink. They have different ways of dispersing it to you. They can even go by and get you with a needle that you never feel go underneath your skin. So these type of things, I do believe they use for interrogation methods, because Frank Olson was starting to develop a little bit of a conscience. And that's probably what got him thrown out of a window. Is that he started to worry about, you know, these interrogation methods that were so extreme, and they were using a chemical that he had, you know, basically manipulated to work against innocent people that, you know, bad things were happening to them and they didn't do anything to warrant it. You know, it's not like they were taking out prisoners, you know, that had done terrorist activities or anything. I mean, these were just normal people they were testing on.
Yeah. And the document, I guess, issued on June 11th back in the late 1950 or so, was that the essential element of the program is physiological research leading to a better understanding of the constituent factors in human behavior. Essentially, according to that Dr. Gottlieb that you talked about, his goal was to induce a person to perform acts, short or long term, which he normally could not be expected to perform. They really wanted this behavior control. And so the next step in this was this Project Artichoke, which was a CIA project that researched interrogation methods, and it rose from Project Bluebird. It was, okay, what's the best things that we got from Project Bluebird, and now we're at Operation Artichoke. And what this was supposed to do, according to an internal memo, was the agency seemed to be looking for a method of inducing amnesia in persons from whom information had been obtained under the effect of special drugs or hypnotism. The idea was that foreign agents should never remember that they had talked to CIA interrogators. That was kind of their dream of this whole program, that you could give this drug orally. They wouldn't know it. They would reveal anything that, you know, you wanted to know, and then the person would have complete amnesia for the event, which seems like a pretty perfect kind of interrogation technique.
Absolutely. And think about how long it took them to perfect it, if they really did go on to perfect it. You know, I tend to think that's debatable. But if you talk about using chemicals to alter someone's mind to where you can erase their memory, that kind of stuff is not reversible. So you talk about people that come out of these different experiment programs and they have identity conflicts. They don't have the complete loss of identification. You know, they don't know who they are anymore. A lot of them ended up in mental wards, asylums. You know, you're struggling with all this traumatic cognitive fracturing that they're doing to you.
Yeah, because, you know, and everything that I've ever seen with MKUltra, for the most part, everybody goes, oh, LSD, LSD, LSD. But honestly, I don't think it was just LSD. I mean, they were trying all kinds of drugs, right? And LSD just is the one that everybody seems to always talk about.
Oh, yeah, let's be real. They were trying everything. I mean, everything. Because when you talk about Laurel Canyon, which you have, you know, they were flooding the musician circles because they knew they liked to use drugs. They were flooding just the crack cocaine. They were flooding MDMA, all that different stuff, along with LSD, through those communities and seeing what the effects were. And
yeah.
You know, a lot of people that got a hold of it. I mean, look, we talked about Diane Linkletter, right? This was the mm-hmm. era of Diane Linkletter. She threw herself out of a window also, because she could not handle the effects of what was happening to her. You know, she had a really bad trip.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, you know, they didn't know how much to give to the person. And maybe some people, you know, have a different biological thing inside them, which causes it to react differently. And so what they did originally was sometime in about 1952, the CIA set up a small testing facility at its then downtown headquarters in Washington, D.C. and they began testing the LSD on individuals, presumably CIA volunteers. But the Artichoke Report wasn't promising as far as LSD was concerned, because LSD, it even said, you know, we've achieved results in producing confusion, but they haven't shown any usefulness for interrogation, because it's just a drug to party on more than a drug to, you know, get any kind of information at all. And so then you, when they came out with this, then you're thinking to yourself, okay, well, they're going to try and alter it and make it different and see what else that they can do. And, you know, just more mind controlling drugs. And it just,
there's no telling what all they're mixing, because I don't even think that everything that has been released is, you know, exactly to this date what they use.
So one of the things that I think really pushed Frank Olson over the edge, besides him being a guinea pig that he didn't know about right away, is that, you know, it wasn't just the U.S. that was doing this. I mean, obviously the Soviet Union, Chinese, the North Korean, they were using mind control techniques on U.S. prisoners of war in Korea. And so the CIA says, we got to do something like that. And they partnered with MI6. And Frank Olson went to the UK and witnessed innocent soldiers who thought that they were testing a cure for the common cold, but they were administered steadily increasing doses of sarin nerve gas, which resulted in horrible deaths. And, I mean, they think they're testing for the common cold. Soldiers. People that, you know, are in your own military. And you're just giving them this until you figure out, okay, we want to see that you know, what ED-50 and LD-50 of sarin nerve gas does to somebody. And if it kills them, it kills them.
Yeah, they thought that was the ideal control group, because here they have these men. They've built them to be who they want them to be. You know, they've had a lot of training. They can practice a lot of restraint. So if they give a control group like that something that should spin them out of control, you know, they get to witness the effects of what that is like. You know, that's a lot different than giving it to a child or, you know, a woman who's not having any type of military training. That was a really good test group. And, you know, if you ever think that you work at a dysfunctional workplace, I mean, just look at the Army, you know, what the government does to them or what the CIA goes on to do to their own operatives. I mean, they will test on each other.
Yeah. And so he goes to the UK, sees this horrible thing, and then he goes to Berlin, which at that point, this is the height of the Cold War, and you've got the Korean War going on. And he witnessed several brutal interrogations involving torture and the use of drugs while there. And it was, I guess, so horrific for him to watch that when he came back to the U.S., he told a friend, a co-worker at Fort Detrick, a guy named Norman Kornoyer, that he was disgusted with what the CIA was doing and was determined to leave. And this kind of set him about in motion, kind of how he was going to end up dead. There was something called the Deep Creek Rendezvous, and it was going to be, the cover story was a winter meeting of script writers, editors, authors, lecturers, sports magazines. And it was at this, you know, retreat at this Deep Creek Lake retreat. And he thought that they were going to be there. Frank Olson thought they were going to be there to talk about the joint projects of the Special Operations Division at CIA. You know, things like what he worked on, biological warfare, using drugs for mind control. But unbeknownst to him, it was the reason they called it camouflage was it was a camouflage story to get him and others to the cabin for an experiment. And, you know, this group were there, and they drive out there, and then they were met by this doctor, that Sid Gottlieb guy, and his deputy, Robert Lashbrook, who will come back into this also. And these guys all had a big dinner, and then they settled down in the cabin for some after-dinner drinks. And then you had this Gottlieb and the deputy served all these bottles of Cointreau. And it was laced with LSD. And they didn't tell anybody that they were being drugged until after they had ingested it.
By the way, you know, the stuff that you've been studying this long, we just fed it to you.
I mean, it just shows you, these are the people, these were not low level kind of, you know, employees. You know, Olson was the director of all this kind of stuff, and they're just given to him. and everybody else not saying. And he was super angry after he learned about being dosed without his consent. And it just kind of confirmed for him, these people are immoral. You know, it just, this is not where, you know, I want to be.
He had to have known what was eventually coming, because when you look at, he was around for this huge mass poisoning that happened in France, and it was in 1951. It was the Pont Saint Esprit, mm-hmm. poisoning of the bread, and it sickened over 350 men, women, and children. So, I mean, not only did it happen to innocent people unwarranted, but it also happened to a United States ally. At the time, we had the Nuremberg Code, which said that you could not, you know, ethically dose people without essential human consent, and they were doing it anyway. So in the back of his mind, he knows that. And then he probably saw no stop sign in sight. You know, at what point will they stop doing this? It's just going to continue on and on and on. And there was rumors that he was going to say something to them, or that he had started speaking out to his family about it, you know, talking about things that he shouldn't talk about, like, hey, this really bothers me. This is what's going on at work. And, you know, the CIA started to mitigate the damages here.
Yeah. So on November 23rd, so this is Monday morning, it was Monday morning after this weekend, and he tells his supervisor that he wanted to resign. And according to Frank's kids, his decision was based on the ethical concerns regarding the CIA's conduct, especially, you know, he saw the interrogations and he was ticked off about being, you know, given the drug without his consent. And then I guess he told his wife later, you know, everything's fine, I'm not going to resign. But his boss and Lashbrook, who's the deputy to the Gottlieb, they convinced him to see a psychiatric doctor in New York. But instead, this psychiatric doctor, he was actually meeting with a guy named Harold Abramson, who was an allergist pediatrician who was working with the CIA. So, you know, then he's in New York in November 28th. They go to New York to see this doctor, and then the doctor recommended that Olson be placed into a mental institution for recovery. And this goes back to something, just that one line reminded me of something that they did, that the OSS did during the World War II, was when somebody knew too much and they didn't want to kill them, they would send them to a psychiatric facility in Washington, the same place where John Hinckley was, is now. And that's where they would send them until the war ended. And this is kind of feels like the same thing. I mean, yes, he had some LSD, but, you know, it hasn't really caused a whole lot of reactions to a whole lot of people. But they can tell that he is not happy being there. So what better way? We'll just send him to a psychiatric facility. And then that's when he suffered this, quote unquote, paranoia and nervous breakdown. And was in room 1018A at the Hotel Statler in New York City.
Yeah, so the whole time that they're dosing him or getting someone to dose him this toxic stuff, they're calling his wife and they're saying, okay, he's violent. And they're basically setting up the stage. They're setting up the script for, you know, everything that's about to happen. And you and I have talked in the past about, you know, how perpetrators will drag in witnesses. You know, they'll drag in someone to help them find the body, or they'll drag people into the script that helps support, you know, whatever it is they're about to do. And they kind of do this with a wife because they're going, he's so crazy, he's so violent. And in the back of her mind, she knows that he's not.
I know, but they messed her up forever too.
Yeah, they're just setting the stage for them throwing him out this window and say, look, we told you. See, he was crazy.
The manager of the hotel, this Hotel Statler, his name's Armin Pastor, he heard a thump outside and went out to find Olson dying on the pavement, having fallen from the 13th floor. And the manager later found that a phone call had been made from this room 1018A to a number in Long Island, and the caller had said only, Olson's gone. Then there was an anonymous source in December of 2010 who said that the call was from Lashbrook to Abramson, and it said, well, he's gone. And the reply was, that's too bad. And then they both hung up at the same time.
That Robert Lashbrook was his roommate at the time that he threw himself out of that 10th story window. And I assume that guy was some type of handler who was supposed to be watching him, or, you know, someone maybe waiting on someone else to come in behind him.
Yeah,
that
you know,
guy, go ahead.
No, I think that, you know, I think you're kind of right, because he's, you know, he's a deputy to a doctor, you know, so he could, you know, be a handler in the sense of, you know, kind of watching, but can he do the dirty work, right?
Probably not, because when they went into that room, they had to bust in because he was locked in the toilet and he was actually frozen sitting on the toilet, and they were trying to get him to talk to them. So I don't know if someone say, hey, go in there, you know, shut the door so you don't have to be a witness to this. Because when I tell you the guy, Frank Olson, took a swan dive out the window. Okay, so it was 2 a.m. in the morning, completely dark in the hotel room. Him and, we assume, Robert Lashbrook are sleeping. Frank gets up out of just the clear blue, takes a running start across the floor. He's able to clear the bed, not trip over any furniture, and go out of a window that not only was closed, so that had to hurt, but also it had the curtains drawn.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. He had to jump over a radiator that was under the window that rose up above a little bit. And the other thing is, this is a typical old-school New York hotel room where there's not really room to do much running. So to get that kind of running start and leap over the radiator at 2:30 in the morning, the curtains are closed, but yeah, I'm going to hit it perfectly right there at the glass because I know it's there. And then it seems improbable. You know, to say
it does, unless these guys had been involved in some kind of, I don't know, central intelligence agency at what, Olympics? I mean, how did the guy do that over a radiator?
I know. And the thing is, so Lashbrook, okay, they found him locked in the bathroom. Oh, I'm frozen and all this kind of stuff. But by the time Olson had hit the pavement, he was already making that phone call, right? So, and then I guess he makes the phone call, and then, okay, now my job is to go into the bathroom and just stay here until the police get here. And the police got there and they searched his ID, and they realized that he had the address and the telephone number and initials of this guy Mulholland in his wallet. And it was interesting because Lashbrook had said something that Olson had visited Mulholland before his death, and this created a lot of controversy and led to Mulholland greatly distancing himself from any, from any involvement. It's a guy named John Mulholland, and he was a highly trained magician, a friend of Houdini. And Houdini had actually worked for the government before, and this Mulholland was recruited by the U.S. government to help train agents in the art of espionage and trickery and deception, including, I'm guessing, maybe, hey, how to dose LSD into the drinks of people who, you know, don't see it coming, and then you kind of disappear off into the background.
Absolutely.
It was during the height of the Cold War that the story goes that the CIA paid $3,000 to him to write a manual on misdirection and concealment and stagecraft. And they thought that they had destroyed all the copies back in 1973 because the CIA was trying to hide everything. But the manual resurfaced, and I know you've read it, the official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception.
Yeah, it's quite handy. Especially, I would say, in our line of work, it's, you know, it's useful.
And one of the, there's like pictures in there and things like that. And there, think about magicians concealing people on a stage, like the sawed-in box, right? Well, imagine, okay, I'm going to teach the CIA a similar system to transport a spy out of, you know, Eastern Europe or something inside a modified fuel tank, or creating a cavity for a person to hide inside cases of bottled water. That was another one. And then one of the things that he talked about in the book, although it's really two CIA agents who wrote it, but is one of the crazy things is, you know, everybody had tied shoes then, and you could lace your shoelaces in such a way where it was a code word, like, I have information, follow me, I brought another person, things like that, where you didn't actually have to speak. It's just kind of crazy. Or rubbing the back of your neck because you can see it from a long, long way away, and it looks natural. And it's great as a signal because it's almost never done. Nobody really rubs the back of their neck. And I just, it's, if you had, it was other things like magician tricks where if you needed to pick a document up off a flat surface, right, what you do is you take this book that has dabs of wax on it and you set it down and then it picks up the paper. And that's, you know, it's just all these magician tricks to help, you know, the CIA and agents and stuff like that. And just, it's kind of crazy that, you know, but in a way it's not, because you're thinking, okay, I mean, Harry Houdini spied on the German and the Russian militaries for England. There was this British magician who created dummy submarines and fake tanks. So it just, it's kind of things. But, you know, Mulholland was kind of more creepy, dirty. I mean, that was the whole, you know, the Operation Midnight Climax part, right? Because you got the CIA, the brothels in New York, and the clients who are being slipped the LSD and then monitored and stuff like that.
The agents would sit behind a two-way mirror and they'd sip martinis and sit there and observe, you know, what the prostitutes had the Johns doing while they were all laced up on LSD.
And, you know, there was one CIA Christmas party where there's a memo saying, you know, hey, do not spike the punch bowls, because I guess colleagues were considered fair game, and everybody just wanted to relax at this one Christmas party. So there's a memo saying, don't worry, it's not going to be spiked. You're not allowed to spike it. We just want to have some fun.
Laugh, because, you know, if you have to put out a disclaimer like that, you should probably avoid the punch bowl. You know, I would say don't eat or drink with the enemy. When you look around, you know, at your desk at the CIA agency in Langley, you know, you're not trusting those people next to you, I assume.
So the police had seen this kind of thing before, and the police at the death scene compared his death to that of this guy named Lawrence Dugan, who was a high-level government official suspected of espionage. And, you know, he plummeted from his office building in New York. And in the CIA Manual of Assassination, it says the most efficient accident is a fall of 75 feet or more onto a hard surface, and domestic dissidents must be handled accordingly. You know, Olson would have been perceived a domestic dissident. And the Mossad for years used Frank Olson's murder as a blueprint for the perfect public murder. But was it perfect? To me, you know, as we, you know, sit here talking about it, it seems improbable. So it's not really the best murder. I don't think it's the most perfect.
It's
public
not
murder.
Because too many people started talking about it. If they had just left it alone with him lying on 7th Avenue, then fine, it is what it is. No one could have ever proved otherwise. But as some of the operatives that worked with him, because I take it he was a likable guy, as they spoke more about him, especially to the family, you know, they got up all in their feelings, they spoke to the family, and the son will tell you, the more they talked, the more they put their foot in their mouth. It led the son to look for more things that were damaging to the CIA. And before they knew it, you know, I call it like they were kind of like in their litter box and they just couldn't cover it up anymore. You know, it was what it was. They had drugged him. People had realized that classified documents were stored under what is known as medical, even though they weren't medical. So a source was able to go and find them, read them to the family. And, you know, they put two and two together, which inevitably ended up with the family getting a $750,000 settlement from the government.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that, you know, the government said, oh, he couldn't handle the little LSD experiment and he committed suicide and all this. And, you know, there was that dose 9 days before his death. That was the one at the resort or whatever. And then, you know, I think you and I agree that perhaps this allergist doctor, when he went to visit him, he probably dosed him again with LSD. And like the CIA had this, oh, is it a suicide? Is it a misadventure kind of thing? And, you know, obviously, you know, it was murder. And one of the things is that this one of the sons, Eric Olson, who there's a website called frankolsonproject.org, and I encourage you to go look at it. And it's got documents. It's got, you know, just this long, long story about everything that was going on. And you had this son, Eric Olson, and in 1975, the Washington Post published several front page articles, which I've got the picture up for you. And it just said that one of the stories in this 1975 front page reported that the agency had infiltrated and spied on 17 anti-war and black political groups. And then, but there was this other headline, Suicide Revealed, and it talked about the story described how a civilian employee of the army had jumped to his death from a New York hotel window after being drugged with LSD during a CIA meeting. And the dead man was not identified by name. And if the circumstances of the reported suicide had not closely matched what the Olsons already knew, they would have never known that the CIA had been involved. You know, he said that, you know, he was shocked at this deliberate LSD drugging. I mean, LSD, the CIA, and that it was so bizarre and that it just kind of came out of the blue. And the fact that his family hadn't been notified, that the father's name had been withheld. So he figured, okay, this full story is still being repressed and he had to take some action. So this is an interesting thing right here because it kind of goes with the news this week. So a month after this Washington Post story appeared, the Olson family held a press conference in their backyard. They wanted full disclosure of the facts. They announced they're going to sue the CIA. And in the backyard, there's tons of reporters, including Hunter S. Thompson of Rolling Stone, which I find interesting, but also Leslie Stahl of CBS News, who was in the news this week. So 45 years ago, she's in the backyard of the Olsons at this press conference. I just thought that was kind of interesting. And then right after this press conference, I guess it was President Ford invited the Olsons to the White House, and he apologized on behalf of the federal government. He set in motion Congress approving that $750,000 you talked about. And then the CIA director, and this is kind of important too, his name was William Colby at the time, and he also wanted to give an apology. And he met the three children in his office on the seventh floor at Langley. And apparently, he was cold and controlled and he was tense and awkward. And this Colby in his memoir, he said that the meeting with the Olsons was one of the most difficult assignments I've ever had because, it's the only time they were really busted, with this whole thing.
Just way too many talks. And, this family, the Olsons, they were one of the first ones ever to receive, maybe the only in time, to get a president to give an apology from the Oval Office. Normally they will apologize to victims from the Rose Garden or, from a place offside of the White House. But, this was inside the Oval Office. And then on top of that, you have the director of the CIA saying he's sorry. But he met with the family and he said, I'm going to give you a file that will answer a lot of your questions. And he gave them a file, but it was useless. It was all word salad, and it just frustrated the family more, and they considered it more of the CIA just muddy in the water.
And it made it even more like, okay, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense with what you're saying. And
the agency's not going to out themselves for doing something wrong. And the thing is that you'll have a lot of operatives that work under, the CIA branch. But the thing is that not all the operatives know what the other ones are doing. So there are people out there that are accomplishing great feats, amazing things with the CIA. But then you have the people that are operating kind of out of the scope of acceptability. And they'll say, well, we'll just tell the director later.
And so this guy, Eric Olson, he essentially has spent his whole life looking into this, to the detriment of relationships and money and all this kind of stuff. But he went, to New York, spent a night in room 1018A of the old hotel, and he saw how completely ridiculous the whole scenario was. If his father had been truly mentally deranged, why did Lashbrook take him to a room 13 floors up? And then, like I said, the way the window was positioned, it was blocked for the most part by a radiator. It's kind of crazy. And then, the manager of the hotel, the one that had, gone outside when he heard the thump in 1978, he wrote to the Olson family on stationery from a hotel where he was working in Maryland and told him he was convinced the CIA was lying about what happened. And that's when there was, learned about that the hotel operator and everything, and that kind of, oh, he killed himself, well, he's gone and that's too bad kind of thing. So it was just.
What I think is interesting is that the son brought up a term that I don't know if he came up with because I've never really heard it before, but a national security homicide, which I think is very fitting for this, because they look at this guy, he's one of their scientists, he's in the army, and they say, you know, we got to mitigate a means to an end here. You know, this guy knows about classified operations, not only in the United States, but abroad. You know, he can be very detrimental to, you know, our entire organization. So, you know, these people, they're walking on the dark side. You know, they're operating in this whole paradigm of where anything goes, you know, because who's watching? And they decide to take him out. They can't just come out and say, oh, by the way, you know, we murdered him. We threw him out of a window.
And in 1978, right after Eric had gone to the hotel room and realized this, I'm not saying that this is connected, but it's kind of weird, is that the Eric's sister, Lisa, had used part of her money from the settlement to invest in a logging business, but she never got the chance because in 1978, right after that happened, en route to upstate New York in a small plane to see the mill, Lisa and her husband and their two-year-old son crashed into a mountain and died. So maybe, hey, yeah, we know you went to that hotel. Maybe, you know, take it back a step, because what it did was it kept him away. He went to Europe and didn't even think about it really for 6 years because of, you know, the devastation of his sister dying. But in 1984, he comes back to America, and he and his brother and their mother met Dr. Gottlieb, and which is kind of interesting. And they were aware from the Senate investigations that he had not only drugged Frank Olson, but had also worked in assassinations. Gottlieb admitted to congressional investigators that he had personally delivered anthrax to the Congo in 1960 to be used for assassinating the president of that country, but the plot failed. And when Eric heard this, he became convinced that his father was not an LSD suicide, but rather a CIA assassination. Like you had said, a national security kind of homicide. And this Gottlieb guy, he met with him. He said he destroyed all the files on MKUltra because he didn't want any trail for congressional investigators to pursue. And Gottlieb thought that when the Olsons showed up, they had made an appointment, but he was convinced that they were going to just open fire on him and kill him. And Eric said, well, you know, I brought up the idea of murder, and he got angry, and he told us, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, there's no reason to be here. And Gottlieb said, quote, I can see you're still wrapped up in your father's death. I recommend that you join a support group for children whose parents have committed suicide.
Yeah, they started calling him obsessed and trying to basically pigeonhole him into believing that he was crazy and things like that. But he was 9 years old when this happened to his father. And he said, you know, as a child, all I could think about was lying in the bed and just remembering that federal agents were likely throwing my father out of a window.
Then they met with that Lashbrook guy, and, you know, he had also retired, and he was a nervous wreck, I guess, and kept claiming he was forgetting things. And the meeting didn't really yield any information until time worked to their advantage, and I guess Lashbrook forgot the cover story.
That guy wasn't real bright, locking himself in the toilet, forgetting things. They might want to cut their losses with that one.
You know, they can't – he was never suspected of involvement in the death. And everybody, even Eric, is pretty convinced that he was purposely kept out of the loop because he was an idiot. And also, as the primary caretaker, he would have been a suspect, and that he probably was ordered out of the main room and into the bathroom. But he – Lashbrook has given conflicting accounts. In the original statement to the police, he said he was awakened by a flapping window shade after Olson went out the window. But that same morning, he had told a psychiatrist a different version, that he woke in the middle of the night and saw Olson standing in the middle of the room out of bed and wanted to start to find out what was going on. And then Olson ran toward the window and hurled himself through.
Like he wouldn't hear a man going through glass in a structure.
I know, right? And then there was, I guess... in 1994, people were talking about the Olson case and asking whether he was jumped or pushed, because they had found somebody who had worked on the MK Ultra project. This guy named, I'm not going to remember his name. The last name's Feldman. I can always remember that. And that he was one of the ones who had run the CIA, brothel kind of operation. And Feldman didn't want to talk about it, but he did say that it was very logical that he was pushed. So then what they did was they wanted to wait until Frank Olson's wife passed. And when she passed in 1993, they said, Eric and his brother said, let's dig up the body. And they did. And they got this professor who was really well known for doing autopsies on bodies that had been dug up. And it was just kind of, I can't believe that after 41 years you could even find anything, really.
Well, yeah, they exhumed him basically to try to figure out if the injuries that he sustained, if all of them were collectively from the fall, you know, going out the window structure and hitting the pavement, or if he was roughed up ahead of time. But it seems like that, like, forensically, they couldn't figure that out. Like, the autopsy revealed that, yeah, he had some damage, but, you know, we can't really mitigate here if it happened before, during, or after.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's tough. I mean, they didn't find any cuts or anything, which would be expected, you know, that he had shattered the window as he jumped. But I guess there was a large bruise over his eye, which the guy hired by the family said, well, he's probably hit with a blunt object before he went out the window. But can you really tell? I mean, if he landed, you know, on the ground, he's going to have a bruise and more. I thought that was kind of interesting. But here's the thing. That bruise actually did mean something, because 3 years later, there was a bunch of CIA documents that were declassified. And one was talking about in 1953, which is the year that Olson died, that the CIA planned to assassinate 58 Guatemalan leaders. And the second was an assassination model that described the circumstances of his father's death almost exactly. It said, you know, told operatives how to create a contrived accident. You hit somebody on the temple and then drop the subject from a high window. I mean, so then you're like, okay, it was written in 1953. He was killed in 1953. And, you know, just kind of.
So within that incident, they learned something, and then they went on to brag about it because they spend so much time, you know, learning to do these different spy crafts and tricks of the trade and stuff, and they want to write about it. They just can't help themselves. So this is what I'm talking about with the families. As they went on to uncover stuff, the CIA became complicit in it because look at how dirty their hands were. You know, every document pointed to the fact that Olson was murdered by the people that he worked with. There was thousands of documents released in relation to just MK Ultra, and Olson's name is all three of them. And also, if you want to deep dive, like the 1951 Point Snaresbury poisoning, those documents are just crazy because it talks about a company like Sandoz Chemical Company being involved. And it also talks about those documents needed to be buried, you know, so apparently they weren't because they were released.
So when Eric found these documents in 1994, he and his brother went to a lawyer, and because they wanted to sue the government, but they had signed a waiver back in 1976. You know, the settlement agreement said that they had forfeited the right to sue the government. But if Eric could prove fraud on the part of the government, that they could do that. So the only way to do that was to prove his death was a homicide. So they tried to persuade the Manhattan District Attorney to reopen an investigation, and he agreed. And he assigned the case to two prosecutors. Okay, now get this. 1 week after they reopened the case, the former CIA Director William Colby, a key witness, he vanished. His body eventually washed up after a reportedly suspicious boating accident. So then next, the prosecutors wanted to interview this Lashbrook guy, but he fought their subpoena, and he went so far as to tell the sheriff who came to his house that he didn't know anybody by that name. He was finally forced to give a deposition. Now, they really wanted Sidney Gottlieb, but guess what? Right after this happened, he died. So it's just kind of... it's just kind of crazy that all that happened and things like that. And
oh yeah, anytime they need witnesses for something, there's always a series of unfortunate events.
So, you know, it's just kind of crazy about this, all of this going on. And there is a Netflix series about all of this. What's it called again? I forget.
Wormwood.
And I guess Eric says he likes a lot of it, but doesn't like some of it.
Well, yeah, because the filmmaker, Errol, he he hit on a lot of the most important points, but some things he would not tackle truthfully head on. So they kind of butted heads on that. You know, he wouldn't go in hard on the CIA because, he realizes that, yeah, they do some bad things, but, you know, they do some good things too. You know, you like to be safe at the end of the night, don't you? So he didn't want to go in too hard, and that kind of bothered Olson. I guess he's a junior.
I think that it's going to go on. It's going to continue to go on. There's been a former CIA director who said that he might be willing to help if he's allowed to, and to answer questions and things like that. You know, it's pretty obvious at this point that it was a homicide. I feel like everybody kind of knows it, and Eric has, spent, 20, 30 years or whatever working on this, and has essentially destroyed his own life to, to do this.
Yeah, and that's sad, because I don't think that he's ever going to reach the type of closure that he's looking for. You know, they've went out and they've shown him that they're capable of doing it, that they could have done it without admitting that they did it. So I don't know what else he's looking for. You know, they've also settled with him, and normally with a settlement will come papers, right, that say that you're not going to keep poking the bear. You know, it is what it is. We've admitted that something happened. I'm not going to tell you exactly what. Here's some money. You know, go away. And I know it hurts. You know, it's hard to tell victims just to stop digging, but, for his own sake.
Yeah, I mean, because we already know the answer. You know, I mean, he even said the CIA will never admit to anything. The financial settlement's the only way we can hurt them. All right.
Well, he knows that because their whole slogan is to neither confirm nor deny. So he knows they're not going to tell him.
I mean, it's so many times you and I do these things and we're like, was he murdered? Did he commit suicide? And, we argue back and forth. And I mean, this one, obviously a murder. The government pretty much without saying it in so many words says it's a murder. And they're real sorry. And we gave you some money. And now, you're coming after us for more money. So I guess we'll just see what happens, but I think it's also remarkable that when they did finally get the district attorney that everybody all of a sudden died off really, really quickly.
Yeah. They opened it and they closed that just as quick as they opened it in 2001 and said, guess what? We no longer have any substantial evidence to follow. So everyone, I don't know, fall into place, go on about your lives.
Well, I can't wait to see what you find for us for next week. I'm excited.
Yes.
And it'll be the Friday before Halloween. So that'll be good. And maybe we'll have a little special Halloween treat for everybody, too.
Ooh, yeah, let's do that.
All right. Well, you have a great weekend, and I will talk to you again next week.
Yes, thank you. And everyone stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.